Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I suppose since he's the president, he gets to have the last word on how this financial crisis came to pass.
A culture of irresponsibility took root from Wall Street to Washington to Main Street.
But the new regulations the White House proposed today aren't really the end of this discussion. They're more like the end of the beginning of it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by Super Brands, Brand Week's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brand Week Super Brands for more information.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 17th of June. Good to have you with us. President Obama's plans to overhaul this country's financial markets runs 101 pages. It's neatly packaged with a green cover and the Treasury Department's logo on the front. And as he announced its contents this morning, the president didn't leave any doubt as to where he thinks the blame for this financial crisis lies and why he thinks some new rules are in order.
It is an indisputable fact that one of the most significant contributors to our economic downturn was an unraveling of major financial institutions and the lack of adequate regulatory structures to prevent abuse and excess.
Obviously, there's a lot in those 101 pages for us to talk about today. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale starts things off with the high points.
There are three parts to the White House proposal. The Federal Reserve Board would get new authority to keep tabs on financial companies that get so big their failure would endanger the entire system. The president would also create a new agency to shield investors from exotic and risky financial products. And he would restructure regulatory agencies to prevent banks from shopping around for the easiest overseer. But the president's proposals leave much of the existing regulatory structure in place. His plan eliminates the weakest cop on the beat, the Office of Thrift Supervision. But the rest of the overlapping alphabet soup of agencies would survive. At the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, David Hirschman says the proposals don't address the real shortcomings of government oversight.
Too many regulators simply don't have the insight and the expertise on the firms they're regulating. They're regulating businesses that are leaps and bounds ahead of them from a technology standpoint.
Today's restructuring proposal is a more specific targeting of the companies and government agencies that Barack Obama has been blaming for the financial crisis since before he was president. His language hasn't changed much since campaign rallies like this one in Toledo last October.
Everyone was living beyond their means. From Wall Street to Washington to even some on Main Street.
The president wants congressional approval of his regulatory proposals this year. But with a full agenda already there, regulatory restructuring may have to wait. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Beyond rethinking who regulates what, as John mentioned, the president talked this morning a lot about risk.
One of the reasons this crisis could take place is that while many agencies and regulators were responsible for overseeing individual financial firms and their subsidiaries, no one was responsible for protecting the whole system from the kinds of risks that tied these firms to one another.
So, in a perfect White House world, the Federal Reserve will have new powers to regulate any institution that could pose a risk to the system. The FDIC could seize it if it ran into trouble. Hedge funds, insurance companies, and banks would all be under one risk management umbrella. From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The Fed would become a sort of super watchdog with powers to prevent any one firm from dragging down the entire financial system. Karen Shaw Petru is with Federal Financial Analytics. She says the Fed would have new authority to police firms that aren't banks but often act like them.
Some of the big hedge funds, it could be GE, as long as GE owns a bank. Big insurance companies. It's really a very, very wide swath of the financial system.
The plan also calls for a council of regulators led by the Treasury Department. The council would advise the Fed and coordinate between agencies to make sure no one's taking too much risk. In the event of another Lehman Brothers or AIG, the government would also have new tools to prevent an economic catastrophe. Mike Pagano teaches finance at Villanova School of Business. He says during the financial crisis, officials have had two choices when a big firm has run into trouble.
Do you let them go under, like they did with Lehman, or do you bail them out? It's really what you had a choice between.
Under Obama's plan, the government would have a third option: close the doors, break up the company, and sell the assets to investors in an orderly fashion, much like the FDIC does with banks. Of course, the hope is, with all the new protections against excessive risk-taking, that option won't be necessary. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The other major part of today's financial overhaul has to do with you and me. Anybody who's ever taken out a loan or even a credit card understands what the president was talking about today when he said this.
The most unfair practices will be banned. Those ridiculous contracts with pages of fine print that no one can figure out, those things will be a thing of the past.
What the White House proposes in response is a new regulator, one that would work for consumers, help them figure out what lenders who hide behind those confusing sales pitches are really trying to get at. It'll have the catchy title of the Consumer Finance Protection Agency, CFPA, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
Everyone who sells consumer financial products would have to answer to the CFPA, whose mandate would be protecting consumers, protecting them from complex credit card deals and mortgages, and pushing lenders to offer more plain vanilla products with less fine print. The current regulatory system is split among several agencies, and Ellen Harnick with the Center for Responsible Lending says lenders take advantage of that.
I think the key thing is that you as a regulated entity don't get to choose the weakest regulator.
Over at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, Peter Wallison is troubled by the new regulator. He says it'll paint with too broad a brush and deny savvy people products they understand just fine.
Some distinction has to be made between consumers. That is, for some people, it's not too risky.
Wallison says overregulation will stifle the innovation of new financial products, and that could end up hurting ordinary Americans. Not so, says Ellen Harnick.
If you don't regulate, then you have unlimited innovation, including extremely damaging innovation.
The kind of great ideas that created credit default swaps and subprime adjustable rate mortgages. But Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics says consumers won't be able to rest easy until the culture on Wall Street changes.
There's different types of predatory behavior. I mean, at the highest level, you have the biggest banks that are really not profitable unless they do bad things.
Just regulating financial products, he says, attacks the symptoms while leaving the underlying cause untouched. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
I imagine some of those biggest banks that Chris Whalen was just talking about breathed a huge sigh of relief today. This was TARP payback day. Nine banks wired a total of $66 billion into the Treasury Department's accounts this morning. That leaves them free, or almost free, of the regulations that came with that money. On Wall Street this afternoon, mixed was the message. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One thing a lot of people do when they want to get a handle on how the economy is going is to look at the big package delivery services. That'd be UPS and FedEx mostly. And the economic snapshot that FedEx gave us this morning was anything but promising. The company lost more than $800 million in its most recent quarter. Officials blame the results on high fuel prices and slumping demand. But confirming once again that timing really is everything, Joel Rose reports the company's purchase of Kinko's 5 years ago didn't help much either.
FedEx says revenues were off 20% compared with the same quarter a year ago. On a conference call with reporters, company officials said the recession means fewer people are using its FedEx Express and freight services. But CEO Frederick Smith says there is light at the end of the tunnel.
While the severe global recession continues to throttle somewhat FedEx's growth, we do see signs of stability as the rate of decline appears to have leveled off. We believe the worst of the recession is likely behind us.
But the recession accounts for only some of FedEx's problems. The company's fourth quarter results included more than $1 billion in write-downs, mostly on its investment in Kinko's. In other words, FedEx is admitting it paid too much for the office services chain it bought 5 years ago for $2.4 billion.
They just paid a lot of money to buy Kinko's. Even several years ago, it didn't look like a good deal. It looked like they overpaid for it.
Stifel Nicolaus analyst David Ross says FedEx misjudged how quickly the internet and cheaper home office equipment would reduce the demand for brick-and-mortar copy stores. Ross says FedEx managers probably felt like they had to compete with UPS and its chain of stores.
Kinko's really the only thing out there they could buy. And, you know, at the time, things were going well, so they didn't mind paying a little bit too much.
Or a lot too much. FedEx has now written down 70% of the price it paid for Kinko's. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
For all the talk of economic recovery that you're hearing, it helps to remember this. Most of the recovering that's going on out there is at the national level, things like the entire economy losing fewer jobs. But you break it down a bit to states or even further to cities, the recovery gets less clear. Some big metropolitan areas are doing all right. Others really aren't. In a report out today, the Brookings Institution surveyed the country's top 100 cities. Only 10 of them are showing any signs of bouncing back at all. So for starters, I asked Alan Berube from Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program why one of them, Austin, Texas, is doing so much better than the others.
Like a lot of the other better performing metropolitan areas, it's first about what they do. And Austin, of course, is a state capital, so a concentration in government has been a good thing. That's an industry that really hasn't shed many jobs over the course of the recession. And it's a university center as well, home to a big one, if not the biggest public university in the nation. And that's a sector that's actually added jobs over the course of the recession. So, you know, what people do in Austin accounts for some of their performance.
Not surprisingly, Detroit, Michigan is on the bottom of almost every metric you guys use. Gross metropolitan product, housing prices, unemployment. It's way down there on all of them. Not really a surprise at all, is it?
No, I think that's probably a story that's pretty well understood. It is the heart of the auto belt, and it shares this pain with other metropolitan areas that are part of that belt or part of the supply chain for it, like Toledo, Cleveland, some metropolitan areas in Indiana and Kentucky. The striking thing about Detroit is that, you know, we looked at performance over the course of each metropolitan area's recession based on when it reached its peak in employment and in output. And in Detroit, that peak was in 2004. So it was on the downslope a long, long time before the rest of the nation was.
What about other manufacturing cities in this country? I mean, you'd think they'd be having a tough time, but really your report says some of them are doing pretty well.
They're making aerospace equipment in Hartford. They're making plastics in Scranton. They're making photovoltaic cells and imaging equipment in Rochester. The demand for these products has remained, again, relatively strong over the course of the recession compared to a lot of other manufactured goods. And their regional economy is showing the benefits of that.
Yeah, you know, regional economy, interesting point. There is a tendency when we talk about the economy, whether it's business journalists or politicians in Washington, to talk about a single national economy. But really, from your point of view, there are 366 metropolitan economies that you really have to consider, aren't there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's, of course, been this relentless attention to the national figures coming out of Washington, the jobs, the GDP, the unemployment rate. And we think that tends to miss what is a tremendously diverse U.S. economy on the ground. And we look at that economy through the lens of metropolitan economies, our labor markets, our housing markets. And when you look at it through that lens, you find, yeah, all metropolitan areas have been hurt to some degree, but that pain is shared very, very unequally. So on the way down, this is an uneven recession, which indicates that when we finally turn the corner, it's going to be potentially a very uneven recovery.
And does that then say the treatment will be uneven, that cities will not get equal assistance as this recovery goes forward?
I mean, I think that depends on the response of policymakers. So one of the purposes in doing this assessment was to make this the mental map for national policymakers, you know, the metric for how they ultimately judge the success of national economic policy should be the performance of our leading individual distinct metropolitan economies. And the kinds of measures that have been adopted and pursued thus far, broad monetary and fiscal policies, I'd argue these were no doubt necessary, but in fact, they may not be sufficient. So I think we're going to need to focus on policies that have particular relevance for the places that don't look like they're poised to recover very soon.
Alan Berube, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Alan, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Coming up, the new outsourcing.
It used to be about saving costs. Now it's because that's where the opportunities are.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials inched down 7 points today, a tiny fraction of 1%, closed at 8,497. The NASDAQ, on the other hand, gained 11 points, 2/3%, settled at 1,808. The S&P 500 nicked off 1 point, 1/10%, wrapped up at 910. Bank stocks declined today after Standard & Poor's downgraded bank credit ratings and predicted less favorable operating conditions for banks due to the prospect of tighter regulations. Shares in Citigroup and Wells Fargo both sank more than 5%. Capital One Financial lost almost 3% today. Healthcare shares advanced. Pfizer, the world's biggest drug maker, pumped up nearly 3%. Johnson & Johnson, the biggest maker of healthcare products, gained 1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note is nudging back up. It's now 3.69%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In New York, a monthly look at where the economy might be headed. The Conference Board releases its index of leading economic indicators for May. In Chicago, the American Cancer Society holds a forum on cancer in the workplace. The agenda covers issues like creating a culture of health at the office and how to understand the financial and social costs of cancer. And the curtain rises on the Los Angeles Film Festival. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. For all the president's politicking about it the past couple of days, work on overhauling the health care system didn't officially start until this morning. That's when the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions held its first formal hearing on the topic. Between the White House and Congress, there are a couple of reform plans floating around out there, all of them with trillion-dollar price tags. But other than how to pay for it, the biggest fight is shaping up to be whether the government ought to offer some kind of public insurance option. Commentator Robert Reich says there's really only one choice.
The only way to ensure that medical costs will be contained by any upcoming health care bill is to include a public Medicare-like option that people can choose as their health insurer over a private insurer if they want. Although most Americans who know about the issue favor a public option, and the president has said he wants it in the bill, don't bet on it being there in whatever emerges from committees days or weeks from now. Most Republicans don't want the public option, and many Democrats are being lobbied heavily against it. Pharmaceutical companies don't want a public option because they fear it will be so big as to have substantial bargaining power to get low drug prices. And private for-profit insurance companies don't want a public option because they fear it will underprice them. After all, the public plan won't have to show a profit. It just has to cover costs. Both these powerhouse industries are saying a public option would be unfair. But what's unfair to them may be a boon to you and me if it means lower prices and premiums. If politics is the art of compromise, as the saying goes, we may get a public option, but one that's barred from negotiating low drug prices, or prevented from charging less than private insurers, or allowed to come into existence only if, at some point down the road, private insurers have failed to lower medical costs and expand coverage by some amount. In other words, we'll get a public option that won't be able to deliver substantially lower prices. which is the whole point of having it in the first place, and the whole reason why drug companies and private insurers don't want it. So there's really no room for compromise here. Either we'll have a public option that disciplines private insurers and offers lower prices and premiums and thereby contains healthcare costs, or we won't. In the meantime, don't be fooled by the label. Just because a healthcare bill includes something called a public option doesn't mean it's the real thing.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Online really works best. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Back before Twitter, before everybody and their dog was on Facebook, Rupert Murdoch paid more than $500 million to bring MySpace into the News Corp empire. Everybody said he overpaid for the social networking site, that being part of a big corporation like News Corp would be the end of MySpace's cool. Well, let's just put it this way. The site that calls itself a place for friends is now more like the place for pink slips and a longing for the days gone by. Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports.
In case you didn't get the bulletin, 30% of MySpace employees are losing their jobs. The company says the 400 layoffs are a first step towards reviving MySpace's, quote, startup culture. For a translation, I called tech blogger and analyst Christopher Null.
Startup culture is actually a euphemism for forcing everybody to work long hours for low pay. So,
see, I thought startup culture meant that you got to start having raves in the office.
Right, and you got to have a keg in the break room, too.
Alas, those days are gone. Null says MySpace has to streamline to compete in a field it used to dominate.
MySpace has been the market leader in social networking for many years. Along with that usually comes complacency. They are realizing now they need to retrench, cut costs, and compete with the elephant that's coming up right behind them, which is Facebook.
More like the elephant that's trampling them, Facebook has long had more visitors outside the U.S., and e-commerce analyst ComScore says in May, Facebook edged out MySpace in domestic traffic, too, with twice as many users as a year ago. Still, Null says MySpace's return to its startup beginnings doesn't actually signal the end.
You know, music right now is dedicated to MySpace. A lot of bands, you know, speak to their fans exclusively this way. It's a real phenomenon, and I don't think it's going to just go away.
But there are rumors the company's about to undergo a total revamp of its site. I mean, at least that's what I heard on Twitter. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Engineers weren't always thought of as the coolest people in the room, the whole pocket protector stereotype and all. They did usually have jobs, though, when it was tough for others to find work. The rise of the high-tech economy has finally given engineers a measure of respect. I mean, who doesn't love somebody who can figure out your computer networking problems on the fly? But now, engineers are losing their jobs faster than people in a lot of other professions are. Even graduates of the best schools are getting laid off as companies downsize and outsource or offshore operations to other countries. And the answer is not all about finding cheap labor either. Janet Babin has more now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Meet one of the changing economy's recent victims.
Hello, Marketplace listeners. My name is Josh Exlin. I live in San Jose, California.
Exlin graduated from Stanford University last June with a master's in mechanical engineering. He specialized in electronic gadgets. He quickly landed a job as a systems engineer in the semiconductor industry. Now, you're probably thinking, boring. Actually, Exlin designed robots. But it didn't last long. His job was soon outsourced to another country.
I didn't think that after 4 months of employment and my first job out of grad school, I would be laid off with 900 other people in a semiconductor industry.
According to industry trade group IEEE, engineers of all stripes are losing their jobs at a faster rate than other professionals. When the economy sours and money's tight, research and development becomes expendable, and so do the engineers that staff R&D. Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft, and IBM have shed thousands of jobs this year, many in technology. And it's not just new hires. Civil engineer Rick Clark spent 11 years at IBM. He had experience in several departments, including real estate and manufacturing. Clark thought his job was secure. Then in January,
my manager called me into his office. I expected him to say, "You're safe." But he surprised me and said, "You're included in a layoff."
That wasn't the only surprise. Clark's manager handed him a brochure about an IBM program called Project Match. It offers laid-off employees new positions with the company. But they're in emerging markets like India and China. Engineers there typically earn less than half the salary of their U.S. counterparts. IBM transplants like Clark would earn the going rate.
I considered it an insult. You know, it's pretty common knowledge that IBM has been offshoring jobs. So this is sort of, you know, like a cold slap in the face.
IBM wouldn't discuss the program. Companies have long outsourced jobs to save money, but that's not the only reason firms are shifting highly skilled workers overseas these days. Vivek Wadhwa at Duke University's Pratt School of Engineering says globalization has transformed world markets. Wadhwa says firms need top talent where markets are growing the fastest, and that's places like India and China.
It used to be about saving costs. Now it's because that's where the opportunities are. That's where they can develop their futuristic technologies. That's where they can bring in lots of revenue. So if you're developing products for foreign markets, you want to understand foreign customers.
And some workers revel in the challenge emerging markets provide. Wim Elfrink is chief globalization officer at Cisco with a background in engineering. He's Dutch-born and spent almost a decade at Cisco in California. Then he agreed to start up the company's site in Bangalore.
Nothing is comparable to India. My boys are 8 and 12 years old, so also for them a new schooling system, leaving the comfort of California behind them, was quite a transition.
Cisco's goal is to have 20% of its workforce from all levels of the company based in Bangalore. And it's hiring engineers. Josh Exelon, the Stanford grad, says he'd consider a move like that, but now it doesn't look like he'll have to. After 6 months of searching, he landed a new job in his field. He started last week. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today to mark the passing into bankruptcy of another brand name retailer. Eddie Bauer filed for Chapter 11 protection today. The story is a familiar one so far in this recession. The company took on more debt than it can handle. It's now in the same league and chapter of bankruptcy court as Circuit City, Mervyn's, and Linens and Things. Although Eddie Bauer is familiar enough with life in bankruptcy court, it got out from under a previous filing just 4 years ago. And that is Marketplace this Wednesday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow was down 7 points, not even a tenth percent. The Nasdaq climbed 11 points, two-thirds percent. The S&P 500 fell one single point, a tenth of 1%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, young children, rusty ships, a dangerous combination.
The cutting isn't straight. It makes metal splinters, which can fly up into my face. Thank God they've never hit my eyeballs.
It's another installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.